I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Growing up in a house where there's all type of like African-American just artifacts that are everywhere. There's King, there's Malcolm, but there's also Ali, there's Robinson. And this culture fuels you to be proud of who you are.
That's Gianni Clarkson. He grew up in Detroit in the 1980s. His dad was a history teacher, but Gianni says his earliest history lessons didn't take place in the classroom.
You know, field trips to Motown Records, down where I went to school in downtown Detroit. And there's a major church that's in downtown Detroit, Second Ebenezer, which is the last stop of the Underground Railroad. So it was everywhere for me.
But the people and events Gianni learned about at home and in his neighborhood didn't always show up when he was at school. Sometimes, he says, history about Black Americans was missing.
I remember one time doing a teacher that was white was teaching about World War One. I immediately rose my hand and was like, well, are we going to talk about the Harlem Hellfighters? And they went, who? Well, that's not in the text.
The Harlem Hellfighters were a group of Black soldiers in World War One who fought with the French army because many white Americans refused to serve with Black soldiers. Gianni went on to become a history teacher himself. He taught middle and high school in Washington, D.C. for more than a decade. He's now an educational consultant. And those gaps he noticed as a kid in the way Black history was taught, he says they're still there today.
The lack of attention paid to Reconstruction. Ooh. If you look at most social studies standards, Reconstruction is like, and we all lived happily ever after, the end. And it's not true. When I first started teaching and I'm looking at what happens after Reconstruction, I'm going, well, that's peculiar. We're going right into the Great Depression. We missed something, didn't we?
Gianni says we shouldn't avoid teaching tough topics and that even young kids are capable of understanding.
Introduce this topic simply here. If you work for someone, should you be paid? Well, what if I told you that for a long time, there was a culture of people that inside of our country were not paid to work? And if they did not work, the worst of things would happen to them. Would you consider that fair or would you consider that unfair? So let's dive into the history of the transatlantic slave trade, why it happened, who benefited from it. Are there still evidence of these things that are in 2023? It's real simple, but we just have to be brave enough to do it. That's all it is. It's just being brave enough to have these conversations.
Former teacher and educational consultant Gianni Clarkson with one answer to a big question we're posing today. How should American educators engage their students on the topics of slavery and Black history, especially at a time when classrooms across the U.S. have been thrust into a political debate about race and our country's history? We're joined today by Danielle Allen. She's the James Bryant Conant University Professor at Harvard University and the director of the Edmund and Lily Safra Center for Ethics, also at Harvard. Danielle, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be with you, Kimberly.
And we're also joined by David Blight. He's Sterling Professor of American History at Yale University, where he's also the director of the Gilder Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition. David, welcome back to you too.
Thank you, Kimberly, and hello, Danielle.
Hi, David. Good to hear your voice.
Same here.
So I want to start off by asking both of you, to answer that question just off the top, what's the first thing you think of when someone asks you, how do you teach slavery in American classrooms today? Danielle, I'll start with you.
Well, it's an incredible thing that we have the chance to do so much now that wasn't possible when I was a kid. I will just start by saying that I really resonated with the story that you started the program with when I was a kid. Seven-year-old, eight-year-old, I used to ask my teachers, you know, what was life like for enslaved people? They would all say, well-intentioned as they were, you know, we can't tell you, Danielle, we don't know. So I definitely went through school with a kind of curiosity and a wonder that wasn't satisfied. We now have, thanks to the great work of people like David Blight, in fact, so many incredible narratives available. So many other folks have dug through the archives. So for me, a really important thing is we can now really teach the history of enslavement in the voices of, with materials written and articulated by people who were enslaved or who found their way to freedom. So primary sources is sort of job number one, and in particular, telling the story from the voices of the perspectives of the people who actually experienced enslavement is job number one.
David, what do you think?
Well, I too loved the piece with Gianni, the teacher consultant from Detroit. I grew up in Flint, Michigan, a similar place. I was a high school teacher first for 7 years in the 1970s when we were simply trying to create Black history courses, literally for the first time in public schools. Doesn't mean we did it very well at first because most of us had no training in it. But what I think of first when I teach about slavery, I've been doing it for so long, it's the way I teach anything else. However, one has to be entirely aware that this is a difficult history. It's a hard history. It's very complicated by the fact that it was racial slavery in the Americas as opposed to other places in world history. But you have to face it straight on. And for teachers, it means you have to learn it first. And as Danielle was saying, not only has it a great change occurred in scholarship, frankly, for half a century now, slavery has become one of the most explosive and continuing research fields of all, but also in teaching. For more than 25 years, a lot of us have been conducting seminars and institutes for teachers who are frankly eager to know this history because they want to teach it. So we are responsible not just to teach our college students, but to help public school teachers all across this country learn more and more and more of this so that they get up with confidence in front of their students to try to tell this story.
Yeah, and Danielle, talk a little bit more about that, how to give educators the confidence to tell these types of stories. I too grew up outside of Detroit, Michigan, and I remember in school the same sort of narrative that, you know, slavery happened at some point, you know, then came Abraham Lincoln and the 13th Amendment and everything was better. But I knew in part because of my mom and reading things outside of the classroom, you know, learning about people like Ida B. Wells and others that I didn't learn in school. So how do you sort of build that around educators to make sure they have what they need?
Well, I really appreciate that reference about learning about Ida B. Wells from your mother, and that's so powerful given your own professional role as a journalist. In my case as well, just to add one more story there, in high school, similarly as to my experience in elementary school, my school did not celebrate Black History Month. And so my dad encouraged me to ask the school for a bulletin board and to do my own Black History Month presentations, which I did. I got a bulletin board in the sort of dustiest, darkest, most untrodden quad in the school. It was the only one left, but at least it was better than nothing. And so I did. I post about Frederick Douglass, Ida B. Wells, you know, Mary Bethune McLeod, McLeod Bethune, and so forth. So I really resonate with the ways in which our families have carried on these histories and given us that breadth of knowledge. So your question about educators is, in some sense, how can we make sure that all educators have access to a whole array of knowledge that some of us have been fortunate to get through our families over generations? Professional development is really key. When you look around at educational policy right now, when you look around at policy around civic learning or history and the like, and supporting excellence in that, a number one plank in the policy is investment in professional development for educators. Educators need time. They need to be able to sit at institutes like Professor Blight's and really take in all the history. There's a lot of catch-up learning, honestly, that we all broadly need to do. The other piece of it is helping people really think about how to navigate the emotional complexity of a subject like enslavement. I love something called the Compass for Courageous Conversations by Glenn Singleton. It makes the point that we all approach material from different perspectives, some with head and analytical questions, some with the heart and emotional reactions, some with the spirit wanting to go straight to evaluation and moral judgment, and some with the hands getting ready to take action, asking what we can do. So enslavement is a topic like that, where some will bring really probing questions, others will have immediate emotional reactions. And in the work we do with educators, we really work to help them be able to recognize where each kid is in entering a hard topic like enslavement. And then we work with them to help them think about how to make sure every kid walks around all four points of that compass. So maybe you start with an emotional reaction. We'll make space for that. We'll recognize it. We'll respond to it. But then we'll also get to a place where we can engage you in inquiry, in following the line of analysis to understand what happened and why and how things changed.
And David, you know, teachers have to teach a lot of difficult subject matters, teaching about wars or other atrocities, natural disasters that have happened, like the Dust Bowl. What is it about teaching about our history and enslavement that is a particular challenge for educators?
Well, I want to go back to that word you used, Kimberly. I think you said, you know, slavery ended, the 13th Amendment came, and everything kind of got better. That word better. What we're always trying to overcome, and look at this debate that has been stimulated, especially in Florida, but in many other states now, that you shouldn't teach this, that this is traumatic, that you don't want anybody to feel bad, and so on. That's rooted in this very old idea that you just can't kill, and that is that Americans believe their history should somehow always be getting better, always be improving, always be a story of progress. And it simply isn't. It's one of the first things you learn in studying history. That doesn't mean that all human nature and all human societies are at their root evil and horrible and so on. It doesn't mean that at all. Some are truly better than others. Some are born out of creeds, as this United States was. But slavery is about real people and what they do to one another. And sometimes, as Gianni said, it's about fairness. So you have to start with the basics, but that the most important basic here is that history is not just about everybody always getting better.
All right, I'm going to pause you there. We are talking about how slavery is taught in our schools. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Today, we're talking about how American teachers should engage their students on topics like slavery and Black history at a time when classrooms are caught up in a political debate about race and our country's history. We're joined by Danielle Allen. She is the James Bryant Conant University Professor at Harvard University, where she also directs the Edmund and Lily Safra Center for Ethics. And we're also joined by David Blight, Sterling Professor of American History at Yale University, where he's also the director of the Gilder Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition. So, David, I want to continue with you. We're going to hear from some educators and talking about how they teach about the enslavement of Black people in their classrooms. But if we were coming up with best practices, where should teachers start? Where does that conversation about enslavement begin?
Well, whether they have 1 or 2 days on this topic or 1 or 2 weeks or 1 or 2 months, they need to start with the fact that it's ancient, that all civilizations, so far as we know, have exploited other peoples for the purpose of labor. Sometimes they're exploited as captives. Sometimes they're exploited because they're different. They're the other from over there. Sometimes they're exploited for trade. In America, enslavement became racialized as unlike anywhere else in the world. So even if you only have 2 days to do this, I'm hoping there's at least 2 days, if not 2 months, you got to start with the fact that this is a long history of human exploitation of other people. Sometimes it has been racialized, and in America, we tend to see almost all things through a lens of race. But I'd also say that for teachers, and I know this has been my experience, and I've worked with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of classroom teachers, you got to start by showing kids that this is really part of history, not part of seeking guilt or seeking even responsibility, although responsibility will come out of this. How do societies do this? Why do they do this? And how are whole countries and governments founded out of this kind of story? The United States is in part founded out of a system of slavery. Its Declaration of Independence, and especially its Constitution, had to respond to it. Now, I also think that, last point here, and this is what Danielle does so well, is this is part of our civic history as well. It isn't just part of what one group of people do to another group of people. In order to understand the United States, if you're an American, you really have to understand how this problem of slavery grew with the country and how it ultimately tore us apart and forced us to remake the country out of the Civil War.
So many of our listeners contributed to this conversation. We heard from a lot of them. Joanna Mosher is a fifth grade teacher in Minneapolis. She usually teaches her students about slavery in social studies. This year, she says, she and her co-teacher added to the existing curriculum. Here's part of a message Joanna left on our Vox Pop app.
So first we began talking about Native Americans in the United States. And then we created a large timeline in our classroom. And then we were talking about the African kingdoms, placing those on the timeline as well, the Mali Empire, different African kingdoms, their wealth, the scholars that they had, their traditions, their cultures, and then introducing slavery and introducing it more as European history, as white history.
So, Danielle, listening to that, that made me think about the way I learned about the enslavement of Black people in school. And the story really started with as they departed the boats in Virginia. There really wasn't anything about what came before.
Well, Kimberly, David is on point in saying that instruction around enslavement really does need to start with antiquity and the point that practice of enslaving others has been with us for the whole of human history and around the globe. That's really one of the most painful things about the story is it just brings you into the depths of the terrible things human beings can do to one another. It's also true, of course, that enslavement was practiced in Africa, and we can't forget that as a part of the whole tale and story that we're telling. And the practice of enslaving people in West Africa, Europeans obviously played an extraordinary role, but they were also assisted by Africans who were at war with each other. And as a part of war, internal warfare, were transferring captives and the like. So human history is a very, very messy place. And enslavement is sort of a story in which they're really, at the end of the day, not, you know, before abolition, there aren't a lot of heroes, right? There's a lot of people contributing in a lot of ways to deeply problematic human practice. So the other thing I think it's really important to say from the point of view of teaching and where do you start as a teacher with this is students come into the classroom with such a huge diversity of pre-existing knowledge or pre-existing myths about enslavement. We really try to help teachers start any unit on enslavement by first actually bringing to the surface what students think they know about enslavement. And then it's really important to build space for inquiry around that so that you can sort fact from fiction and help people get to a very sturdy, evidence-based grounding for understanding the history of enslavement.
And David, as I think about this, it's not just what is taught and how it's taught. It probably makes a difference in who it's being taught, to whom it's being taught, and whether the child is somebody who may have had some of that experience before or somebody else, or the race of the students. David, how do educators navigate that, understanding that the audience, each student is different?
Well, with great care. I mean, in my own memory of the first times I was trying to teach about these matters to high school kids, black and white, from an urban industrial city like Flint, Michigan, it was difficult. I mean, black students were learning these things for the very first time in their lives. White students were learning these things for the first time in their lives. And here we were, in my case, in the 1970s, in the wake of the 60s revolutions, in the wake of the civil rights movement. Our city was creating magnet schools to try to defuse a busing issue. And here we were trying to teach some black history. And sometimes, of course, black students feel terribly self-conscious in a when they're 15 and 16 years old or younger. They feel terribly self-conscious when suddenly race is being discussed. Well, what do you think? And what do you think? You got to learn how to do that with care. And again, it goes back to something Danielle was just saying. Our first purpose is to help young people understand what history is to begin with, how it is not just about us. It's about a past that can be a very foreign place, but a foreign place that over time, through multiplications of generations, did make us. I think with young people, the younger they get especially, you've got to try to teach them as an us that all people were engaged in this. Now, that doesn't mean that the fault for slavery doesn't land on somebody, and it surely does. The complicity for slavery, the hypocrisy for slavery doesn't land on somebody pretty hard, because it does. But again, this is where, you know, teaching is two things. It's knowledge and it's personality. And both of those are hard to achieve, but you got to have both of them. You better be prepared to know what you know, but now you got to find ways to communicate it. And the best teachers do both of those, and they do them well. What we need to do is to keep helping build their base of knowledge so that they can take their personalities into the classroom and just excite kids with a sense of history first, and then this story next.
And Danielle, I want you to build on what David was talking about in terms of how it impacts the students. We're going to get in a little later, get into the political climate outside of school that's sort of having an impact. But just these are difficult stories, and it will provoke some sort of emotional response from children, and the emotional response from children of color may be different than white children. How do teachers navigate that?
This is really one of the most important questions there is. It is the case that we are seeking to help young people become self-confident as learners, self-confident with their own voices in terms of expressing their opinions and the like. Excuse me. That is a process about knowledge. It's also, excuse me, one moment. Very sorry. It's also a process that is about personality and emotion. So for us, we work really hard with educators to give them self-confidence, knowing that they are the adults who are going to co-process emotionally difficult things with their learners. What is co-processing exactly? It means that before you engage with hard material, you acknowledge up front that it may be challenging, that people may feel all kinds of emotions. You make space for people to name the emotions that they're feeling in the course of working that through and to talk about it, or you make space for students to be able to say, you know, I don't want to talk about it in class, but I might want to talk about it separately one-on-one. So there's a lot of real sort of specific teaching strategies that you need in order to help learners work together, be the adult co-processing with them so they can take information in, name their emotions, articulate their questions, and turn that by the end of the process into a sense of stable meaning. They can make sense out of a world that is confusing, alarming, etc.
Lois McMillan has been in education for 33 years. She's a high school teacher in Grant Pass, Oregon, where she teaches world history, American history, and an elective class on the American Civil War. She says she doesn't shy away from talking about slavery and race, and the students, the majority of whom are white, really respond.
Last week I taught the What to the Slave Was the 4th of July The kids love it. They get the stinging sarcasm and the absolute feeling you had behind it. I also had students reading slave narratives, the story of Harry Jacobs. You know, one kid said, I understand why a woman would do that. I don't know if I would escape just because I couldn't leave my children. And this is a sophomore boy. His hat's on backwards, and he's wearing a goofy sweatshirt, and he's talking about being a parent and the love for a child. It was a really beautiful moment.
So, David, talk about that, the way what we should expect from students and their capacity to be able to process the words of Frederick Douglass or the story of Harriet Jacobs, regardless of who they are.
Well, first of all, I know Lois McMillan very well. She is a truly great teacher, and she used to coordinate my Summer Teacher Institute, so I know from which she comes. She's amazing. Well, she's dead right. I mean, the 4th of July speech, whether you teach it in excerpts or have them read the whole thing, is the rhetorical masterpiece of American abolitionism. There is simply nothing quite like it as a penetration of the national hypocrisy over slavery. At the same time, it's an embrace of the original creeds of the Declaration of Independence. There's so much you can do with that speech. But also, it sounds like what Lois accomplished there is that she got kids, even this white kid with his hat backwards, to penetrate to the human experience. And she did it with a document, a narrative. And this is the whole trend in teaching, of course, of teaching with primary documents, whether it's a slave narrative or it's a speech or it's a slave manifest from a plantation or a slave sale and so on and so on, or a Supreme Court decision like Dred Scott. When you actually teach real documents, kids are reading about what happened by people who experienced it, and they embrace it. You know, one last thing about this, and I think, again, Lois McMillan's comment may express this. When you teach about slavery, you're actually teaching about all kinds of things. It's the lived experience of slavery. It's slavery as this national crisis for the whole country. It's slavery as a constitutional problem. My God, you can teach so much about civics and the Constitution by looking at it through the lens of slavery. And then the question of race. Oh, my goodness. You know, how did this become racial slavery in America, as opposed to most other places in the world? So it isn't just teaching about the appalling terror and trauma of slavery. It's a whole lot of other history. And young people, you know, they need to learn that because they don't know that at first. And frankly, some teachers need to learn that.
So, Danielle, in 2020, the death of George Floyd spurred so many things, including a change in curricula about the way that lessons about Black Americans and Black America were taught. What changes have you seen there, and can that be sustaining?
One of the things that happened in my own universe, I run a civic education provider, is we found ourselves trying to really support educators with rapid response capacity to help students have hard conversations in classrooms. So hard conversations about contemporary questions, not just hard conversations about historical matters. This is necessary because students will learn about all of the world's difficulties one way or another. Media just so penetrates every aspect of our lives at this point that you cannot actually keep any particular subject out of the classroom. The only question is, how will educators engage with that? So in our experience, when it comes to supporting educators in addressing and providing productive conversations, space for productive conversations about hard contemporary questions, a couple of things are really critical. Again, it really matters to surface kids' questions, to start there, to figure out, well, what are they actually processing and taking in, and what questions is this provoking for them? And then it's really, really important to make sure that for all those aspects of the questions that are about facts, trying to understand, you know, what actually happened, who did what to whom, what is the legal proceeding, how does that relate to our broader juridical structures and the like, educators need to be able to put their hands on that information really, really quickly. Our experience supporting them is that our media universe right now makes that really hard. There's a lot of misinformation out there. There are so many sort of competing accounts of what actually happened and the like that educators themselves, as talented as they are, as experienced as they are, they can really have a lot of trouble sorting through that welter of information. So we found we had a big job to do to provide that, provide really crystal clear evidence-based FAQs for people to support those conversations.
So we're going to have Danielle and David hold for just one moment. When we come back, we'll talk more about how classrooms have been thrust into the political debate about race in U.S. history. Today, we're discussing how American educators should teach their students about the topics of slavery and Black history. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Next week, we're going to talk about the changes to public K-12 education in Florida and how politics has had an impact on classrooms. Florida teachers and parents, we want to hear from you. Teachers, do you feel paralyzed by new legislation and what it means? Or do you support the changes the Florida legislature and governor are making? Parents, have you noticed a difference in what's going on in your child's school? Is it for good? Is it for bad? Share your experiences by recording a message on the On Point Vox Pop app. If it's not on your phone already, just search for On Point Vox Pop wherever you get your apps. Or you can leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. Today, we're discussing how American educators should approach subjects like slavery and Black history, especially now that classrooms have been thrust into a political debate about race and U.S. history. Here with us is Danielle Allen, the James Bryant Conant University Professor at Harvard University, and also David Blight, Sterling Professor of American History at Yale. And yes, we're going to have a show next week that focuses particularly about Florida, but I want to ask you both a little bit about what's going on there now. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has been a vocal opponent of what he calls, quote, indoctrination in schools. He's banned the teaching of critical race theory in Florida and blocked an advanced placement course in African American studies from being taught in the state. Here's DeSantis in April of 2022.
Parents have a fundamental role in the upbringing and the education and well-being of their kids. And I think Biden and his folks believe you send them to school, butt out, and the school's job is to indoctrinate what they think your kids should learn.
So, Danielle, I've heard a lot of this, this issue being framed as protecting the choice of parents or giving parents a greater say in the education of their children. How do you see this?
I think parents and educators are aligned in a sense of purpose and mission. Parents and educators both want to see young people grow as learners, again, develop that self-confidence in the use of their minds, in the use of their voices. Parents and educators both want to see their young people acquire a good, solid understanding of the world that they live in and the like. So parents and educators are fundamentally allies. And I think if you look around the landscape of how education actually unfolds, you will very often see that Every school year starts with a family night. Parents or caretakers are invited to come visit the classroom to talk with the teacher about the curriculum and the like. So I think the governor's premise is fundamentally wrong. I think the other really important question here is where the professional expertise of educators and researchers belongs. Again, if you start from the premise that parents and educators should be allies, then the nature of that relationship, that partnership, is that educators bring a special kind of expertise to the table. It's important that they do, as I know they do, they're always seeking to deploy that expertise in the best interest of the child. The parents, of course, are also concerned for the best interest of the child. So what really matters is that we be able to build a policy environment that supports that productive collaboration and partnership between educators and parents.
Yeah. You know, it's not just Florida where this debate is taking place. Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin signed an executive order almost immediately after he took office in 2022. The order banned the use of, quote, inherently divisive concepts, including critical race theory, end quote, in K through 12 public education, something Youngkin pledged repeatedly on the campaign trail. Here he is in October 2021.
We have some abhorrent chapters in our history. We have to teach them. But friends, Dr. Martin Luther King called us all to be better than we are. He called us to judge one another based on the content of our character and not the color of our skin. And critical race theory is a political agenda that is absolutely in our schools. And it teaches everyone to view everything through a lens of race and then pits our children against one another.
So, David, I want you to explain to us what critical race theory is and whether it's being taught in our K through 12 public schools.
Oh, my. Okay. Look, it's a 40 or 50 year old legal theory or concept which essentially says that racism can be systemic. It can be embedded in practices, in laws, in institutions, in companies, sometimes consciously, but sometimes unconsciously, and that we have to understand how that evolves. Now, is it being taught in schools? By and large, no, certainly not as the theory that it was devised as. But as to these governors and state legislatures, let's be honest, and I think you are, WBUR, are honest, and if you're going to take on the Florida issue next week, God bless you. Because this is classic political wedge issue. It's a wedge issue launched by the Republicans. It's very well poll tested. It's very well funded. A governor gets elected on it in Virginia. A governor in Florida is running a state on it and running for president on it. State legislatures, dozens of them, have passed these divisive concept laws. My God, if I didn't teach about divisive concepts, I'd have nothing to teach about in American history. And I think most of us would say that. A last point. Look, this is much larger than critical race theory. It's much larger than one AP course. And it's really about a multi-million, if not billion-dollar effort by the American right to erode, if not actually destroy, public schools. And I greatly admire Danielle's project, this democracy project, the civic education project. God, we need more of that. But I think we need, in this country, a moonshot for public schools, something equivalent to the moonshot mentality of the 50s and 60s, when we wanted to beat the Russians to the moon. A moonshot like something like the call to cure cancer. The most democratic institution the United States has ever created is the public school. And if we don't save it and get more people to want to go teach in them, we won't have a democracy left. And the American right knows that. And by the way, last point, but this animates me. This idea of parents' rights, fine. I wrote a piece in The Atlantic a year ago called Trust the Teachers. Curriculum does not belong to parents. Doesn't mean they can't be consulted. Doesn't mean they can't be brought in and asked and shown. Curriculum does not belong to governors, to state legislatures, or even state boards of education, and it surely doesn't belong to parents. It belongs to professional teachers. Mm.
And Danielle, talk a little bit more about this idea of a moonshot, and also to concerns that parents, some of our listeners included, may have, because this debate isn't just playing out in Virginia and Florida. It's playing out in communities across the country, even in places like New York, Massachusetts, where parents are showing up to school board meetings deeply concerned, genuinely concerned about what their children are being taught, and fearful that it is something that could be harmful to them. So what do you say to parents who have that concern, or are concerned that perhaps the education is of their children is too far out of their hands?
Well, let me back up a little and also weave in a response to your question to David about the Governor Youngkin's comments and the rhetorical framing around critical race theory. Mm-hmm. For a lot of political reasons, Republicans have decided to fight on the subject of how we teach history. And so I think it is actually important to name the stakes of the debate, and to name them in plain language, not fake straw man sort of characterizations and the like. So in essence, you could say that there are two really visible streams of work for how we teach African-American history, other ethnic group histories in the U.S., and American history in relationship to each other. There's a stream that you could think of as sort of integrative and positive. A beautiful example is Ralph Ellison's essay, "What Would America Be Like Without Blacks?" The pattern and practice of this mode of historical work is to make sure that for all the stories we tell about American history, the Revolution, the Industrial Revolution, the Civil War, Reconstruction, et cetera, that we're always telling a complete story, that everybody's story is present in it, and that we are taking forward a sort of interwoven narrative together. That is a big, important, impactful part of the work that historians have done for a long time. There's also another body of work that has done the also important work of really helping us analyze how power operates. Why did this country have practices and habits of racial domination? Where do they show up in our institutions and our laws, and not just in interpersonal relations and the like? This is also very important substantive work. And you need both pieces of that analytical, both of those analytical approaches to tell the whole story, the whole honest story of American history. We're really having a fight right now about whether we get both of those pieces or just one. So, for example, in Texas, where there's also been legislation against divisive concepts and the like, at the same time, they have proactively added African-American ethnic studies requirements to their K-12 curriculum. They have proactively added Mexican-American ethnic studies requirements. In Florida, DeSantis, his budget is putting money into the preservation of African-American history at the same time that they are rejecting the AP course, for example. What is happening is really that the right is saying the history should be entirely of the integrative and positive version. We should not include the parts of the history that are really analyzing how power has operated over time in this country. I think they are wrong on the intellectual merits. And I think we need to say that plainly and consistently across the board. And our students deserve a full and complete, honest history. That's the work, as David said, it's really important that professional expertise from researchers, from educators, be central to that evaluation. There's a civil society job to do to sort out high quality from low quality with regard to any kind of intellectual enterprise of this sort. So that, I think, is really the big frame that we should all bring to this. And it's the question of, will our kids get a complete story, a whole story?
Cheryl Ann Amendola is a fifth and eighth grade teacher of social studies and history in Montclair, New Jersey. She says she's not going to shy away from teaching difficult topics because she wants her students to be able to recognize injustice.
I think it's Mark Twain who was credited with this, but we don't know if he actually said it, that history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. And since I started teaching in 2006, there has been far too much rhyming. And I consider it my sacred duty to help these students grow up in a world where they can see injustice, understand injustice, know when it's coming, and make it stop if they recognize it. And it's my sacred duty to help all of my students live in a world where they can be accepted, more than tolerated, accepted for the skin that they're in.
You know, this point, David, reminds me of a conversation that I had with friends where one, said she was proud of the fact that she doesn't want her kids to see color. And the other said, well, if your children don't learn how to see color, they can't be a part of the solution to the problems we have. That sort of speaks to the point that Cheryl Ann was making.
Yeah, well, first of all, who can improve on that teacher calling her work sacred duty? God bless her. It is. It is a sacred duty, and it's not paid well enough. But, you know, if you teach history really well and we give our kids some time to learn it, they might learn how to do both sides of that. See color, understand it, understand race, why it's been so pertinent to nearly everything in American history, but also learn that we have spent so much blood and energy trying to overcome it. You can learn both sides of that. One last little point, lest we cast all our stones at the right wing on this, and I'm happy to do that most of the time. But sometimes the academic left needs to monitor itself. We don't write for the public too often. We don't write in ways that some of us, that real people can read. And if all we do is run around defending critical race theory, which is important on some level, we're just feeding the beast. We're having the argument on Governor DeSantis's terms. We need to get beyond his terms and to the terms of this kind of conversation we've had to had today. But and by the way, I'm so glad you brought on a fifth and an eighth grade teacher here, because most academics wouldn't have a clue how to get up in a fifth grade classroom and teach 10-year-olds. And these teachers have something to tell us about what a 10-year-old can actually learn. And as so many teachers will tell you, kids can deal with most of this. They know there's complexity in life. They know there's unfairness in life. They've been unfair to their sibling this morning. They get that. And history is full of it. So meet them where they are. When they're ready for it, teach real documents with them. They love it.
Yeah, Danielle, we have a little less than a minute left, but one concern Lois McMillan expressed is that this debate is pushing good history teachers out of the profession. What do you say to them to make them stay?
Oh my goodness, it's just such a real concern. We are losing good people. We are seeing people who are pulling books off the shelf, even though they don't necessarily have to, just out of fear. There has been a massive chilling effect. I say, our country needs you. Our children need you. This is far too important. Maintaining a commitment to the truth, to full teaching, to honesty is a moral responsibility.
Danielle Allen is the James Bryant Conant University Professor at Harvard and the director of the Edmund and Lily Safra Center for Ethics. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And David Blight is Sterling Professor of American History at Yale University, where he's also the director of the Gilder Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition. Thank you, too.
Thank you. So glad to be on with you.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.